Thank you, Rodney, and thank you, panelists, for that interesting look into school culture. Good school culture, we learned, is something that fosters schedule and order and love and acceptance, and it, in short, prepares students for adulthood. And good school culture also has board members and principals that help shape that culture. So thank you for those insights. Next up, we have a topic, evaluating the effects of digital media. Ryan Horst is bringing to us this topic. Ryan has had a particular interest in this and has spent a good bit of time researching this. He has shared this talk at various other places, and we will look to him at this time to bring us this talk.
All right, good afternoon to everyone here. We had a wonderful lunch, and we've been sitting for a while now. Let's all stand together. And let's just sing a rousing quick verse of I Sing the Mighty Power of God. I sing the mighty power of God that made the mountains rise, that spreads the glowing seas abroad and built the lofty skies. I sing the wisdom that ordained the sun to rule the day. The moon shines full as its dumb and all the stars obey. All right, it's been enjoyable to be here today. I'm no longer teaching school. I taught school for a while, and I do sit on a board as a past representative for a small school that we have. But this topic was more, it was actually something I was asked to share at a teacher's training week in someone else's place. It's kind of unique how I got into this in the first place. I think it was during COVID, and whoever it was couldn't come north across the border, and so they wondered if I would take that slot. And I said, well, what was the topic that had been assigned? And they said it was something to, I think, evaluating the effects of technology was what it was called. And so that's something I've had an interest in. I would like to study into it more. So I'll take the same topic, even though they had offered that I could choose a different one. And so it's been something that I've had an interest in, and I hope that as we look at this topic today, you can learn something that's helpful for you. I'm well aware of the fact that this is a topic that meets us at a variety of different places, and it's somewhat intimidating to share because of that, but also from an educator's perspective, I don't know how many teachers there are here today, but they say that you should know above and beyond in any topic that you need to teach. You shouldn't be at the brink of your own knowledge when you're teaching, and I think the same is true as decision makers, as board members, as pastors. We need to know more than just what we need to know, if that makes sense. It's helpful and healthy to have an understanding that's a bit broader than maybe where we're at. So I recognize some of the things I may talk about might not seem like they're day-to-day issues that you're making decisions about, but I hope it stirs your thinking. I'm certainly not anti-media, but I shared a version of this talk at a school, and somebody came up to me afterwards and said, you didn't have one good thing to say about media or technology. And so I guess my burden is that we, number one, fear the Lord in as we relate to this, which is going to drive us to his word. But then two, that we just have caution and wisdom amongst us. And I'm going to come back to this verse at the end, but there's this verse in 1 Chronicles 12:32, I believe it is, that these men of Issachar that had knowledge of the times and they knew what Israel should do, and I just believe we need in today's day and age, even no matter really where our churches are at in relation to media, we're all engaging it at some level, and we're engaging questions at some level, and we need men of Issachar that have knowledge of the times, that know what Israel should do. I also think of Daniel and his friends that the Bible says had knowledge of science. And I think we also need in the body of Christ men who have an understanding of science. And that's kind of where my burden is, my passion is with this topic is, how is media affecting our minds? How is it affecting our children as they develop? And so we're not here to make a lot of declarations about what's good and what's bad, but rather simply to evaluate. And I hope that all of you can do some of that yourself as you listen here. Dr. Jeff Myers is a president at Summit Ministries, and he shares a story that I think is fascinating place to start here. He said that he had a chance to talk with a school administrator from Kansas City, and the school administrator was telling him about a situation that he'd had where six, and this is an inner city school, this is a very different setting than most of our schools. Inner city schools, some needy situations, but here's what the situation was. Six parents came to the school administrator independently, and they said, you know, my child's been diagnosed with ADHD. In one case, the child had been diagnosed as bipolar, and the doctor says that we should medicate. What do you think? And the administrator kind of sidestepped that question. He said, well, that's a medical decision. I'm not going to say one way or the other what you should do, but let's try some things first. He said, I want you to get three nutritious meals a day. He had to define nutrition for these parents. He said, I would like you to get your children to bed at 9 o'clock on weeknights and 10 o'clock on the weekends. Third, he said, I want you to limit video games and television to half an hour per week. And that's not per day, per week. And then take the children outside, or let the children go outside to play for 1 hour a day during the week and 3 hours per day on the weekends. And these parents were kind of up at arms about this. They're like, this isn't going to work. This is, our children are going to resist this big time. And they said, furthermore, our community isn't safe for the children to play outside. There's undesirable characters around. And the administrator wisely said, well, you go outside with them then. Spend time with them outside. And I don't know, do I have a, in my notes here, I don't think I have how long this experiment lasted, but I do know that the testimony was at the end of the time period, none of the children actually needed to be on medication. Now, that's one story, that's anecdotal, it's not a be-all, end-all story, but it does raise some questions. What factors were all at play in these children's lives? What were they missing? And how much did the media fast or the reduction in media play a role in this? I don't have these pictures in this slideshow, but sometimes I show pictures of advertisements that some of you might remember if you're old enough here today. Advertisements of cigarettes from 1950s, and one of them says, more doctors smoke such and such a brand than any other brand. And we look at those today and we say, what in the world? And they also have a picture of an advertisement, again, from 40s, 50s era, where they were targeting children. They were saying, you know, get your dad some cigarettes for Father's Day. How have we gone from there to the labels now on cigarette cartons that show the lungs that are filthy or the hole and so on? How have we gotten there? Well, it's been people that have evaluated the consequences that these things bring, and people who've studied into it from a scientific level and have raised some serious warnings. What I want you to hear next are some, maybe not warnings as much as just how they think, from some of the people who are closest to technology, to media. And then I'll let you know where we're going from there. This is just still by way of introduction here. So, probably a face that you recognize, Steve Jobs, former president of Apple, no longer living. Steve Jobs was being interviewed by a New York Times reporter, and actually, if I have the story right, Steve Jobs had called up this reporter to say you got something wrong in your article, and he was known to do that. So the reporter was on the hot seat and trying to become better friends with Steve Jobs in this scenario, and so he changes the subject and he says, so your children must really like the iPad. It had just come out, this is 2010, and Mr. Jobs' response caused the reporter's jaw to drop. Mr. Jobs said, my children have never used one. And the reporter said, I thought the Jobs family would have touchscreen walls and they'd be sitting at their dinner table scrolling on a screen. His children had never used one. He said, we limit how much technology our children use at home. A couple of fellas that wrote a book Miles and Clement, I think their names were, commented, and they said, in today's public school setting, it's interesting to think about the fact that where every child has an iPad nowadays, the Jobs children would be the only ones that wouldn't. Another familiar face, this is Bill Gates, and here again, there was a limit to computer use in their home. They had a rule that there was no cell phones at all until age 14. And is this thing able to work or not? Okay, you're just going to roll from back there. All right, then I'll stop trying. No, that's all right. Bill himself spent hours in his office reading books, and that was the culture that they had in their home. And Bill's wife, Melinda, said she wishes that they would have waited longer in order to have their children have cell phones. And then family mealtime was also important to them. And same with the Jobs family. It was important to sit down around a table and have mealtime. Go ahead. Here's the current CEO of Apple, Tim Cook. Now, he doesn't have children of his own, but this is 2018. This article was very vocal about the fact that he wants to make sure his nephew is not on social media. Why does this matter so much to him? This fellow's name, you can decide how to say, but he was a former executive, worked at Facebook. He made this statement. He said, "We created tools that are ripping apart the social fabric of how society works." Somebody who knew the technology very, very well. And another former executive, Sean Parker, he actually helped Mark Zuckerberg start Facebook. And here's what he had to say. He said, "God only knows what it's doing to our children's brains. The thought process was all about how do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible. We understood this consciously, and we did it anyways." Facebook's, and not just Facebook, these large media corporations, what gets them up in the morning, the reason their feet hit the floor, so to speak, is their paycheck, like anybody else, I suppose. But how do they make their paycheck? Well, by people using the platform. So their stated goal is that we want to make sure people are on as much as possible. And he's saying, this is actually after he's left Facebook, and he's saying it wasn't right what we were doing. And he's apologizing for it or warning people of the dangers. This is a picture of Silicon Valley. This is the West Coast in California. So a lot of your big tech companies are here. Apple's here, Google's here. And you know what the most sought-after school in the Silicon Valley is? It's a Montessori school. Now, I had to look that up. What's a Montessori school? Well, it's a whole style of education that I don't know a lot about, and it's not really that important. The point is that they really have a focus on hands-on learning. They get the children outside. They're using actual pencils, and they actually have, at this particular school, they made a rule, I think it's 2011, they made a rule that there's no screens at all until high school, and then it's in measured amounts as they progress from high school forward, and they want to help them to transition into using screens wisely. And that's where all of the large, the big names in tech like to send their children to school. I shouldn't say all of them do, but it's the most sought after school in Silicon Valley, apparently, is this Montessori school. There's an article then that sums up kind of everything that I've been saying so far from the New York Times. A dark consensus about screens and kids begins to emerge in Silicon Valley. This is from 2018. The article says, "The people who are closest to a thing are often the most wary of it. Technologists know how phones really work, and many have decided they don't want their children anywhere near them. A wariness that's been slowly brewing is turning into a region-wide consensus. The benefits of screens as a learning tool are overblown, and the risks for addiction and stunting development seem high." And this lady, Athena Shavaria, who works not for Facebook exactly, but for another interest that Mark Zuckerberg has. Mark Zuckerberg is the owner of Facebook, or the founder. She works for another his philanthropic arm is what it said. Anyway, she made this statement. I'm convinced the devil lives in her phones and is wreaking havoc on her children. And it's a strong statement, but she also says that she lives by the mantra that the last child in the class to get a phone wins. Why are all these people that are so close to the technology so wary of it? And then we go to the East Coast. This is Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. And Sherry Turkle here has written a book called Alone Together. And here's what she says in her book, Alone Together, on the East Coast. Here I am at MIT, surrounded by super techies, and same story here, said Turkle, who's based out of Cambridge, Massachusetts. Everybody's at a Montessori school and has rules about no computers at the dinner table, no computers at breakfast, no computers here, no computers there, no computers in the classroom. I mean, same story. All right, where are we going from here? Two parts to where we are going, and the first is on child development. So evaluating the effects of digital media on child development, and then secondly, evaluating the effects of digital media in the classroom. And maybe there's a lot of schools here today that don't use digital media in the classroom at all, and I'm not here trying to promote it, but if we're going to use it, let's be wise about it is more the approach that I'm taking. So let's evaluate what effects it has and how to use it wisely. I have the iceberg, sorry, go back one. I have the iceberg here. For a couple of reasons. One is we're only going to scratch the surface of a huge topic here today. Secondly, the icebergs bring to mind the story of the Titanic. And the Titanic had a top speed of 23 knots, so I'm told. And when it hit the iceberg that was ultimately its demise, it was traveling at 22.5. In spite of knowledge that there was icebergs in the water. And so the lesson that we need to take with us today, really the one major thing that I desire you to take with you is that if we recognize there's some danger here, if credible people are saying there's some danger, we definitely want to move with caution. And I don't think we'll regret moving slower than faster as we make decisions about tech. I want to give credit where credit is due. This is the fellow that I first heard talk about a lot of the information I'm sharing today, Scott Ritzma. Now, I will say he is a Seventh-day Adventist, and there's some things in his material that I kind of waded my way through, and so it takes some discernment, but I did learn a lot, and what I did was kind of listen to what he had to say, and he has a lot of content with Belt of Truth Ministries, and I tried to do some research and fact-check and learn some from other places, too, but a lot of it was through what I had learned from Scott. Scott's also a teacher, former teacher, and just really pulls together a lot of data from a lot of different places. So I found that very, very helpful. Credit goes to learning from him. So let's think about child development. We're going to look at this in four sections, and I'm going to have to hasten on here. You're not going to remember everything, but I hope that you at least get a sense of the big picture as we go through here. Physically, mentally, socially and emotionally, and spiritually, how, as we've seen digital media has been around now for a little while in the broader culture, how is it affecting the children especially? How is it affecting child development specifically? So go ahead to the next one, and we'll look at the first category here. You can throw up all the extras there. One thing that is affecting possibly even our students is being in front of a screen towards the end of the day, and possibly ourselves too. What is this doing mentally, though, to the student, or physically? How is it affecting them physically? Blue light apparently is what tells our body, let me say this correctly, towards the end of the day, when blue light is diminishing, when natural daylight is diminishing, our bodies start to naturally produce something called melatonin. And scientists don't know everything, at least that I'm aware of. There's still some mystery as what does melatonin all do, but we do know it helps us sleep better. It aids in sleep. And so what blue light does in the evening, especially as you're exposed to blue light, it's telling your body, the chemistry of your body, that, hey, it's still daylight, it's not time, it suppresses the melatonin that would naturally be created, and so it's harder to fall asleep, or maybe even if you do fall asleep, you don't have the same quality of sleep. Another way that students are affected is if they sleep with their phone in their room, and I hope that there are no parents here who allow that for their children, especially if they're school-age children. But what's happening for teens is they're getting messages sometimes during the night, and so that's distracting to them. They wake up and they think they have to respond, and there is more and more students coming to school very, very sleepy as a result of that. Thank you. You can go one more to add the notes there. So this was an interesting article thinking about how this media is affecting children physically. This article is from, I think, 2018 as well, from the UK. And they found that the average child spends 7 hours outside a week and over twice that amount of time playing video games inside. We're talking general society. What they actually realized was prison inmates in England were getting outside more often than children were. And it's an interesting comparison to think that we've created a prison as a society. I'm speaking broadly, but we've created a prison for our children consisting of screens. Shockingly, 1 in 10 children that they interviewed said that they would rather do homework than spend time outside. What is it? Children are supposed to love the outdoors. What is it that's causing them to say that they don't want to be outside? They don't want to climb trees. They don't even want to go to the park. Well, it's a dependence on the dopamine hits that they're getting from playing games. They start to crave it. That's all they can think about. Continue. They're also noticing that there's physical skills lacking. Shoe tying, for example. There was a parent that said, made this comment in an article that I had found, that they're taking their child to a soccer game, and there's actually, and this was, oh, I want to say middle school level maybe, they're having to stop the soccer game frequently so that the ref can help to tie the student's shoes. And I don't blame the children for this. Actually, part of what we're seeing in society is parents who are too busy to teach these basic skills. But we're also seeing, you can go to the next one, we're also seeing students who don't have that hands-on or physical level of expertise that they used to. This was an auto teacher, not this particular, I guess I think I just have a generic picture here, but there was an auto teacher that said there was a time where the majority of the students could look at a form and they knew how to fill it out, just follow the instructions. He said now it's like 15% that are actually able to look at a form and understand how to fill it out, just a basic auto form. So there's physical skills lacking. And Roger Kneebone. Now, if your name was Kneebone, what would you do with your life? Roger Kneebone decided he wants to be a professor of surgical education, so I don't blame him for that. But he said the students that they're getting in med school also just don't seem to have this basic understanding of how to use their hands. He says students implied rays on screens often do not have a basic understanding of the physical world. They're struggling to have students that are just the basic hands-on activities, they're unsure, they're not as skilled in because they haven't been used to using that. Gene Twenge's written this book, and I have a lot of books up here on the screen. These are excerpts that I had been exposed to from Scott, so I have not read these books. I can't vouch for them entirely, but I think some of these excerpts are very telling. So she's a professor of psychology from San Diego State University, and she says in this book, iGen, the average teen now gets less exercise than the average 60-year-old. So we're talking about effects of media. How is this affecting today's generation physically? Next slide. What about mentally? If you want to research a very interesting person as to how, just in general, children develop, Dimitri Christakis, a pediatrician at Seattle Children's Hospital, is definitely someone to check into. He has done a lot of research, probably the number one person that's really, or at least close to the top, really scientifically qualified to speak to this topic as far as child development. What he was being asked in this interview is, you know, what about these games, these games that children can learn things on a screen, they can do things on a screen, and he says, what we do know about babies playing with iPads is that they don't transfer what they learn from the iPad to the real world, which is to say that if you give a child an app where they play with virtual Legos, virtual blocks, and stack them, and then put real blocks in front of them, they start all over. So part of this is to say, what's promoted as being helpful and educational doesn't actually translate to, you could say, the real world, the 3D physical world that we live in. It's not actually the same part of the brain that's learning something, not able to use it as a useful skill. Further, there's an article from 2008, this is a while ago, where France actually banned any programming, television programming, that's aimed at children 3 years old and under. In this bottom paragraph here, television viewing, this is what the government had said, television viewing hurts the development of children under 3 years old and poses a certain number of risks, encouraging passivity, slow language acquisition, overexcitedness, troubles with sleep and concentration, as well as dependence on screens, the ruling said. Now, it takes a long time to get everybody on board where you actually make a government ruling. So this is, to me, this is significant that France as a country said, we have a concern here. It's children three and under being exposed to screens. From the time a baby's born, their brain in grams is around 300 grams. 333 was what Dimitri Christakis would say. And over the next 2 years, in the first 2 years of life, it triples in mass. So we're talking about a huge development of the brain. And so it's a very crucial period as these babies are learning. And more professional people that have studied this development are saying, don't put your children in front of screens. Even Canada's, I think it's the optometric, can't quite pull the word together now, optometrist, it's a society anyways that's making some recommendations. Talked to Richard Bean about this. He's an eye doctor, and he had mentioned this. And he said that ages 0 to 2, I think it is, they recommend no screen time whatsoever. Like, don't even look at pictures on your phone with your child and that type of thing. The only exception they would maybe make is if maybe a grandparent or a parent is far away and they're able to see them as far as a social connection. Maybe that could be redemptive enough that it would be worth it, but there's a lot of caution even in general society about young children and screens. Let's just talk a little bit about the brain. We can't go into too much depth here. Go ahead and throw all of those subpoints up. I want to talk a little bit about the frontal lobe. This is extremely crucial part of the brain where your critical thinking happens. And if you're listening carefully right now, you're using your frontal lobe. And so here's some things that happen as a part of the frontal lobe. This is, scientists can tell where various activity happens. Here's where spirituality, morality, the will, prayer, worship, compassion and empathy, discerning spiritual truth, reason and conscience, and decision making all happen in the frontal lobe. Now, I'm not trying to reduce all of these things to it's just a brain reaction. That's not what I'm trying to say. But when you are praying, that is the portion of your brain that is active. And when you are making critical decisions, then that is the portion of your brain that's active. Very, very important. If you want to do some interesting research a man by the name of Phineas Gage. He was a worker on the railroad that was helping to build it that accidentally ignited a spark that launched a tamping iron up through his skull, and it went up through the frontal lobe, and the change in his behavior from before to after, if you can go to the next slide, was significant. He had been a hard worker, he had been a moral person, and after that he was lazy, not consistent in his work. His frontal lobe had been severely damaged, and he became kind of a careless, casual, lewd type of a person. Here's what neuroscientificallychallenged.com says about the prefrontal cortex. It's often implied that the prefrontal cortex contributes a great deal to making us who we are as individuals. According to this perspective, if you took away the prefrontal cortex, we would be ruled by our desires and impulses, lacking an ability to plan for the future or think about the consequences of our actions. Now, just think about that a little bit. Is that what we're seeing in the broader culture today? I'd say yes, we are. We're seeing a generation who is ruled by desires and impulses, lacking an ability to plan for the future. In fact, as they've done some scans, some comparing of brain scans, children that were raised in abusive households versus children who have had a heavy, heavy diet of screens, especially interactive screens or fast-paced videos, video games, there's actually quite a lot of striking similarity in how their brains are developed in a negative way, and I'll get into why that is the case. But just understand, what we're doing with media is actually looking very similar on a brain level to what abuse, an abusive situation can be. To explain that, we'll go here now to look at another section of the brain, the limbic system. This is tucked, nestled deep inside the center, and it's a few different components that make it up, but sometimes it's called the lizard brain because it's the functions that happen here are the same functions that a reptile would have, fight, flight, or freeze. So here's some things that happen there. Fear, aggression, anger, irritability, impulses, lust, worry, and anxiety. And you might wonder, why did God give us a limbic system? All of these things, if you think about how they're meant to function, they do have a place. For example, fear, it's good that we have a sense of fear, that we don't run in front of a cement truck that's barreling down the highway. Fear, though, needs to be, as I've heard it said, elevated to our frontal lobe. So if you're experiencing a fear, you need to think about it. Is this a rational fear? Is this a good kind of fear that's going to keep me from harm? Or is this irrational? And so the limbic system always needs to be in submission to the frontal lobe is one way to think about it. Anger, there's such a thing as righteous anger. Even our sexual desires God has given to us, but they have boundaries. And so the problem is if the limbic system gets out of proportion, if the limbic system were to become dominant and the frontal lobe were to become too weak, then we would have some serious problems. We'll go to the next slide and look at one more piece of this puzzle yet. So we've talked about two different parts of the brain. Now let's realize something. So it's not just my 16-month-old that I have at home whose brain is still massively developing. It's you and I. Something that scientists have discovered over the last number of years, probably, I don't know, maybe 20 years especially, is that all of us, everyone here, has a brain that's what's called extremely plastic. It has plasticity. It's shapeable. It's malleable. It's able to be retrained. And so if you think about it like a path in the forest, the more you walk on it, the more established that path becomes. The same way as far as our brains work. The scientists say the neurons that fire together, wire together. The more you think a certain way, the more you establish a thought process, the more established that it becomes. Neuroplasticity. Think about it like lifting weights. If I were to put my left arm in a sling and my right arm was to pump weights for a good portion of the day, think about what would happen over time. You would have a very strong right arm and a completely weak left arm that wouldn't be good for anything. What is happening with media as there's exposure to, and I want to be maybe a little bit more precise now. What's especially causing this is fast-paced videos where the frame changes every couple seconds. A typical video or movie, the frame or the picture will change every 2 seconds, and your frontal lobe just kind of goes into sleep mode. It's not entirely disengaged, but it's like a sleep mode. And so the frontal lobe's not being exercised. That critical thinking is basically asleep, okay? It's not fully engaged. Whereas the limbic system is often very much stimulated by the type of programming that children are seeing in these movies. Think about the types of things that you tend to, I mean, I hope that we're not watching movies, but we all know enough to know what types of things are shown. There's often violence, or maybe there's a level of indecency, and it's often targeting something that activates the limbic system. Remember, fear, lust, aggression, even extreme comedy. My understanding is that's the limbic system as well. So you have a limbic system that's pumping weights, so to speak. It's being used more than what it should be, and it's overstimulated. And you have a frontal lobe that, if there's a lot of screen time, video games, same thing. So if there's a lot of flashing, you have a frontal lobe that's just not being engaged real much. And we have some staggering numbers, again, in society, broader culture, as far as how much time children are spending in front of screens. My wife, before we were married, was doing some babysitting for a little boy and his little sister. And she said she would notice that they had a TV in that house, and she would notice that If there was a fast-paced program on, there was one show that he liked to watch, that if it was extremely fast-paced, and if that show was on, he wouldn't jump off the couch and acknowledge his dad. He'd be sitting there kind of just glued to the screen. But if it was something more slow-paced, it was different. And it's because the brain kind of the frontal lobe kind of checks out. It's I could go into the specifics, but we'll leave it at that. It's in sleep mode if there's too much activity happening, and so it's really not being exercised. And so how does this affect schoolwork? Well, you don't have that critical thinking. You don't have the ability to process information, make good decisions. It affects the mental state at a pretty significant level. From an expert here, Dr. Nicholas Karadaris, he has helped many, many people with addictions, and not just, drug addictions, yes, but not just that. He has worked with people extensively that have had media addictions, and here's what he says. Listen close. I've worked with over 1,000 teens in the past 15 years and have observed that students who've been raised on a high-tech diet not only appear to struggle more with attention and focus, but also seem to suffer from an adolescent malaise that appears to be a direct byproduct of our digital immersion. Indeed, over 200 peer-reviewed studies point to screen time correlating to increased ADHD, screen addiction, increased aggression, depression, anxiety, and even psychosis. Now, on the other side, people will say, well, it's only correlating. We don't know for sure if the media is causing this. To me, it doesn't matter so much exactly whether we can prove that it's the media that's causing it. It's not helping at all, and I think that's pretty easy to show. I would say as a teacher, I've seen this. In my years teaching, we would chat in the kitchen after school, and Johnny's having trouble focusing in class, and well, you know how it is at lunchtime, the students often chat about what they do at home, and as teachers, we could often, not always, but we could often tell if there was a few students that were allowed to play video games at home of some type, those were often the ones that did struggle. I would say in my own experience, I've even seen this to be somewhat of the case. Not always, but it certainly helps, contributes in a negative way. Let's look at socially and emotionally. How is digital media affecting today's children? And again, thankfully, in our own cultures, I hope that these symptoms are not there, but this is to help us, by viewing it, we can say, let's have some serious caution as we think about how to shape the future, policy, and so on. This Catherine Steiner Adair interviewed something like 1,000 youth children, and she also talked to teachers. She did a lot of interviews, and what she learned from teachers is that children are struggling with what they call EQ, emotional quotient, emotional intelligence, being able to read body language, being able to have a conversation where they have good eye contact, and just having a conversation with good back and forth. Those types of things, EQ, children are majorly struggling. And again, I don't fault the children so much as their parents for this. Today's parents are very busy, and they're in front of their own screens as well, and it's affecting the children. And God help us, because if you have a phone, it doesn't have to have much on it before it can easily be a distraction, even just talking on the phone, or messages, emails that you need to respond to. And what do our children, how do they feel? Are they learning to have good conversations, face-to-face conversations from us? There's also this symptom that I don't think it was her that coined this term, but continuous partial attention, where children are so used to parents who are only half there, and maybe they come running up with their picture that they want to show, Daddy, I drew this picture, and oh, nice, and you're back to your thing. It's become such a problem that they've coined a term to describe it, continuous partial attention. Here's one quote from the book. This is from a 7-year-old. My parents are always on their computers and on their cell phones. It's very, very frustrating, and I get lonely inside. When my dad's on the phone, I have this conversation in my head. Hello? Remember me? Remember who I am? I'm your daughter. You had me because you wanted me. Only it doesn't feel like that right now. Right now it feels like all you care about is your phone. But I don't say that because they will get mad at me and it doesn't help. It feels worse. So that's just the conversation that I have with myself. It's easy to look at the broader culture with judgment and to say where is this all going to lead, but let's be as hard on ourselves. I think part of our responsibility as board members, as leaders in any capacity here today, is to start by setting the right example in these things and making sure that we are placing the proper priority on what matters the most, and that our children understand that they matter so much more than our device. One more observation here. This is extremely sad to me. This is Jean Twenge again. She noticed a spike in teen suicide, especially in teen girl suicide. As she was looking at a lot of data, she noticed an extreme spike in 2012, and she looked at what possibly could have been a factor. And again, this is only correlating, meaning it's happening at the same time. We don't know if it's the cause, but it's the only thing that she could really conclude was that was when social media, things like Facebook and other platforms, that's when they really became wholesale. And a lot of teens had both devices and were starting to get into social media. And there's so many testimonies, especially from teen girls, to the bullying that happens or the lack of how they feel insecure about themselves because of social media. And so, do I have the statistic here? 3 between the years of 2007 and 2015, the suicide rate in teen girls went up 3 times. And as the church, that should break our hearts, and that should also cause us to say, what can we do to rescue the perishing? But it should also be a strong warning as we think about social media, how to relate to it, and digital media, both in our schools and in our homes, to realize that the dangers that do exist as you enter that realm. How is it affecting children spiritually? This is Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell was a British aristocrat that was interested in controlling the masses through education and food, etc. And so kind of an interesting character, to say the least. He's no longer living, but he does say something that is very sobering that I actually tend to agree with him, at least from what we've seen so far. He says, but perhaps the most important of all the modern agents of propaganda is the cinema, leading to an almost worldwide uniformity. The great majority of young people in almost all civilized countries derive their ideas of love, of honor, of the way to make money, and of the importance of good clothes from the evening spent seeing what Hollywood thinks good for them. I doubt whether all the churches and schools combined have as much influence as the cinema on the opinions of the young. The producers of Hollywood are the high priests of a new religion. I'm not saying that I like it, but I do tend to agree with him that Hollywood movies, pop culture, even in our settings, which maybe we've taken maybe more of a separated approach in a lot of these things, it has this trickle-down effect, and we all have to soberly take a look at spiritually what are the effects, how is it affecting the next generation spiritually. On the flip side, the number one factor, this is from the Barna Research Group, probably the number one respected name in religious surveys. He says they did a lot of surveys on not just in Christianity, but in any faith. Which parents are the ones that are successful in passing that faith on, and what are the factors that are involved? And so, of course, this isn't where we look for ultimate direction. It's the Word of God that teaches us how to train our children. But this was interesting to me that this is what they found in their survey. The number one factor in passing a faith tradition to the next generation is that the truths are communicated in an environment of relational warmth and connectedness, in other words, secure attachment. And even for us, if we are living busy lives and we're, as parents, as leaders, if we're on our phones and demonstrating to the next generation that that's what's important, is there that relational warmth? And I would ask the question, since this is a school audience today, is that the culture we have in our schools? Is there a relational warmth and a connectedness in our schools? Even if there's not a lot of digital media, that can still be missing. And I think it's so important that that is present. Okay, part two, and this is the smaller part. We're going to break this into 3 sections. Thinking now more about the classroom, are there positive uses of digital media? If so, what might that look like? How can it actually be used in helpful ways? I want to think about some standards to strive for as we think about, okay, we looked at a lot of data, a lot of it's maybe in a broader culture, but how do we then learn from that? And then some points to ponder that I want to leave you with. So positive uses of digital media. What are some ways, and I'm not trying to promote, in fact, even in using a PowerPoint here today, I hope and trust that it's not offensive to anyone. It's, to me, it's something that I have used to some extent. You've heard me say a lot about the dangers of it. And so I'm very cautious about promoting it. But for those of you who do use it, if you have a projector in your classroom, et cetera, here's some things that I have found helpful as a teacher. First off, I would say typing. You don't need a computer to do this. I grew up back in the Stone Age when we used typewriters still. And some schools, maybe a lot of your schools are still using typewriters. That's entirely fine. But I do think that typing classes are really important. I look at that skill that I'm glad that I was given in my schooling as maybe there were many skills that were important, but to me that one has proved to be one of the most practical, useful skills, and I'm so thankful for it so often. And so I want to say that. I did have a projector in my classroom, so here's some things that I really found helpful in having a projector, some of the ways that I would have used it. It's often where it would just be helpful, you know, we say a picture is worth 1,000 words, and teachers do a lot of talking, and so if you can put a picture up on the screen, sometimes it says a lot in and of itself, and so that can be helpful. Also, sometimes if I had a note that I wanted the students to copy, I would be able to type it out and have it in the format that I wanted, and then put it on the projector that the students could copy it. Now, I also wrote it out on the chalkboard too, and that worked out just fine. It wasn't maybe because I was trying to work at a speed that the students, they could usually go a little quicker, I think, in their books than what I would write on the chalkboard if I would, at least if I would take the time to maybe double underline the headings and all of that stuff. It was just a little easier to have it clean and organized and prepared ahead of time if I'd be able to put it on the projector. So it's a little cleaner, maybe a little quicker. Demonstrating outline format. If you do use PowerPoint, I think it's a great opportunity, even with this outline here today. You were exposed, as you listened to me talk, you were exposed to somewhat of an outline format as I broke it down. We have A, B, C. Here's the different sections. If you do use some PowerPoints for your students, they actually get to visualize what an outline looks like. Oh, okay, so my teacher is going to talk about these three things, and that's how it was broken down, that's how it was worded. So it's maybe just a visual way to strengthen what they would otherwise only hear. And then maps. Maps are both, well, they're cost-effective if you can find a picture online, and they're versatile. So to demonstrate that, if you just go to the next slide, this was a map that I would use to teach the counties, and I had one with the names, and I had one that did not have the names, and so I had the option of zooming in on an area if we wanted to focus on how it looked, or going to the next picture, which was where the names were removed, and so it was an easy and a large, you know, something the whole class could see, a large map that was just easy way to drill those counties, and I definitely found maps to be a huge help to be able to put it up in front of the students like that. And then lastly, one more, yep, review exercises. You can just go to the next slide. I did use PowerPoint somewhat for drills and review, and I actually think that you can overdo it with this to the point where, and some of you are probably sitting here thinking this already, and that's fine, that if the students always need, if they're given a PowerPoint once in a while, or if it becomes kind of normal, that sets a pretty high bar, and maybe the students tend to think, well, if it's not in a PowerPoint format, then it's just not exciting enough. That is a ditch, definitely, and I did try to keep that in mind as a safe, or as a somewhat of a guardrail, that I don't just use it too often, that it that they're discontent with any other way. But something like this, what are the three ways that you can speed up the process to help a substance dissolve more quickly? It was a visual as well as a review, so I could have the question up there, and then I could ask the students for a response, and then I could click it, and it would show up. So I found that helpful. What are some standards to strive for? Maybe just take these one at a time, if you don't mind. So first of all, a proactive school board. We had a lot of school board members here today, and I mentioned at the beginning that even if some of these things aren't direct, you're not being directly confronted with these things, let's be proactive. Let's be thinking about Let's be learning about these things so that we are, as decision makers, that we're well able, instead of being reactive, where it's like, oh, this is a problem that we're having now. How do we deal with this? No, let's be proactive. Secondly, students who are taught the wonder of exploring God's world. It is a wonderful world out there. And let's make sure that our students, as encourage our teachers, to get them outside even. Get them studying the actual physical world and make sure that they're enjoying the wonders of the world outside. And I hope that in most of our home settings, that's still the way it is, that children love to go outside. But something to be thinking about, to be demonstrating to them the wonders of the physical world. Learning that involves and encourages hands-on activities. In a world where these skills are being lost, let's make sure that our schools continue to promote hands-on activities. That can be quite a variety of things depending on what the age level is, but I think the concept's important, especially in the early years. How about parents? Parents that are well educated on the dangers of screen time. My wife and I were talking about this topic, and I was adjusting it to kind of fit the school audience here. And we talked about the fact that on a school level, you can do a lot of things right, but what about if the home setting is not conducive to good learning? What if the students are getting a lot of screen time, or they're up late at night in front of a screen? I think we owe it to parents to try to help them be aware. And I remember some of you might get CLE light lines. I know that Gary Miller had a short excerpt in there, and we sent that paper home to the parents, and different ones of the students commented, like, oh, our parents read that article, and there were some changes that were made, and well, praise the Lord. That's exactly what we want to see. Parents that are sometimes parents just aren't aware of how these things are affecting their children. Class time that's devoted to the topic of digital media, you can put the next three subpoints up. So it could be in the form of a devotional. Encourage your teachers in this way, especially at a high school level. Class discussion is I love doing that as a high school teacher, having a class discussion about this. And I gave the same talk, in fact, much more in depth to my students, trying to help them understand from a scientific level even, but also from a biblical level. If we just follow some basic principles, I will set no wicked thing before my eyes, redeeming the time for the days are evil, etc. A few of those and 95% of the issues disappear because we've already made a wise and godly choice. Maybe 100% of the issues disappear. Or a communications class, science class, etc. Let's make sure that our schools have an environment of relational warmth and connectedness. It's a standard to strive for. And then finally, some points to ponder. You can ponder those physical points as well as these ideas. How much do I understand? Ask yourself, how much do I understand about this topic as a board member, as an individual, as a pastor? Are our parents well informed on this topic? How could we inform them better? Does our school need a media policy? Maybe that's something to think about. I'm in an email group that the school administrators contribute, and the topic of smartwatches came up, and one school was saying, what are y'all doing about smartwatches? And so here's what one of the policies that was shared, just for interest's sake: cell phones, smartwatches, and any other wearable internet connectable devices may not be used by students during school hours on property. Any such devices may be kept in vehicles or in school lockers, provided the devices are turned off. It goes on, but that's kind of the biggest part of that. With a smartwatch, if they have their phone in their backpack, they can get messages. And even if they can't get messages, if their phone's far away, it still proves to be a great distraction, because it seems like the ones who come with the smartwatch are also the ones who get distracted easily for some reason. And so maybe it's something you want to think about as a media policy, or what to do about smartwatches. I want to leave you with this verse that I talked about at the beginning. And the children of Issachar, which were men that had understanding of the times, to know what Israel ought to do, the heads of them were 200, and all their brethren were at their commandment. May God continue to raise up men of Issachar. I don't think we can really escape the effects of media. It surrounds us at some level. But may God give us wisdom to relate to it in a way that honors him, and in a way that's going to be helpful for the next generation, that they can understand the dangers and that they can make wise decisions in the future. I've already shared the actual slides as an email. I can do that for you if you're interested, especially those last few with some of those ideas to think about. If you're like, oh, I just didn't have the time to write them down, definitely feel free to send me an email. It's my last name and then first name, horstryan@hotmail.com, and I can share the slides with you in a PDF format. And I hope that the topic doesn't stop here. I hope that you continue conversations, and may God give us all wisdom as we relate to this. God bless you.